Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents American Foreign Relations, A Very Short Introduction, by Andrew Preston, read by Keith Sellenwright. Introduction. The history of American foreign relations should be of interest to any person from any country. This is because, unlike any other great power since the beginning of the 20th century, the United States has affected the history of virtually every other country in the world. So great has the United States' presence been, culturally, economically, politically, technologically, militarily, that how it conducts its relations with the rest of the world is of unusually wide global relevance. To a significant extent, for better or worse, we all inhabit a world created by American values, systems, technologies, and power, and in turn by the adoption of and resistance to these American phenomena. Understanding the history of American foreign relations is therefore key to understanding the world we all live in. This is not to say that America in the world has been omnipotent or its influence determinative. As powerful as the United States has been, it has failed to get its way on many occasions. Yet even then, in Vietnam or Iraq, for example, the consequences have been impossible to ignore. Nor is this to say that the United States' foreign interactions have always been beneficial. To say that the United States' power is great doesn't necessarily mean that it's always been good. For these reasons, there is a great deal of controversy surrounding the topic of American foreign relations. This very short introduction on such a large and important subject aims to address in as even-handed a manner as possible some of the most important topics and common myths about the United States in the world. First, a word on terminology. I use the term history of foreign relations here deliberately instead of the most common alternative label, diplomatic history. This is because foreign relations is more capacious and inclusive, incorporating not only state policy, military strategy, and high diplomacy, but also non-state interactions stemming from trade, immigration, religious missions, and culture. Given that America's global footprint has often had little to do with diplomats and strategists in Washington, foreign relations, which includes both international history from the top down and transnational history from the bottom up, seems more appropriate and accurate. In highlighting many of the key moments in American foreign relations history, this book is animated by seven key themes, many of which are at various points mutually reinforcing. First is the importance of values and a sense of mission. All great powers are motivated by their ideals, but American foreign relations have been to an unusual degree moralistic and normative. This is because a belief that the United States is special and thus has a special role to play, an ideology known as exceptionalism, has been an inordinately large influence in determining U.S. interests in the world. Second, ideas about expansion and progress have played a critical role in how Americans envision the world around them. At first, this had a literal meaning in the form of territorial acquisition, but expansion and progress have also meant the spread of American values, driven by a desire to change the external world around the United States, not just for the benefit of Americans, but also for the benefit of others. In other words, progress required expansion. Whether non-Americans welcomed American progress is sometimes questionable, but it's also, when determining what motivated Americans in the first place, beside the point. Third, race, gender, and religion have been particularly potent sources of American engagement with the world. The United States was founded as a white, slaveholding republic with Protestantism and manhood as key pillars of political culture. Those who traditionally lacked power, African Americans, women, Catholics, Jews, Mormons, had to conform to the norms established by white male Protestants. Over time, this power dynamic shifted as American society became more pluralistic and as the world decolonized. Yet the authority of these long-standing norms has remained remarkably durable. Fourth is the centrality of war to the American experience, not just the American experience abroad, but American history itself. Two of the most pervasive national myths are that the United States wages war infrequently and that it is slow to go to war. In reality, Americans have often resorted to armed force to achieve their goals, at first on the North American continent and then around the world. In fact, over the past 250 years, warfare is perhaps the most consistent aspect of American foreign relations, and it has had a deep and lasting impact on the evolution of American culture, economics, social norms, and political institutions. By the same token, this shouldn't lead us to perceive the United States as an unusually aggressive, warmongering state, but rather as a nation like any other. No more aggressive, but also no less. Fifth, the basic geographical position of the United States has had a profound, but usually overlooked, importance on its foreign relations. It is surrounded on all sides by an absence of threat, and has been for almost its entire history. This is what historians refer to as free security. Since the end of the War of 1812, the United States hasn't faced a threat of foreign invasion, much less occupation. Over the same period, all of its great power competitors have had precisely that experience, sometimes repeatedly, and only Britain has actually escaped invasion and occupation. The advent of transoceanic air power and nuclear energy in the 1940s complicated American security, but they didn't negate the nation's geographical good fortune. While Americans have come under foreign attack, not least on September 11, 2001, those instances, while horrific, have been exceptional. Sixth is the pernicious myth of isolationism. There has never been a time in American history when Americans simply kept to themselves in isolation, and free security didn't mean that the United States was somehow sealed off from the rest of the world. As long as there has been a United States, Americans have roamed the planet in search of commerce and converts, while the persistence of warfare reflects a darker side of American engagement with the rest of the world. However, it is certainly the case that Americans acted unilaterally, that is, within the world, but on their own terms, for much of their history until the end of the World Wars and the Cold War. This wasn't the same as isolationism, a polemical term which first became widespread as a political epithet during the debate over intervention in World War II. The reason isolationism is pernicious is not only its highly politicized nature, it also allows Americans to believe in a non-existent golden age, when matters were less complicated and Americans controlled their own destiny. Seventh, finally, is the importance of domestic politics to the conduct of American foreign relations, including diplomacy and military intervention. Partly because of America's long-standing culture of popular democracy, and partly because free security removed the pressure of constant struggle for national survival, American war and diplomacy have been shaped by the need for popular and political legitimacy. Even when policymakers wanted to ignore popular pressures, they couldn't. Moreover, the decentralized structure of American governance, federalism as well as a system of divided government grounded in checks and balances and the separation of powers, has provided an almost infinite variety of opportunities for individuals and groups to lobby elected officials, and in turn for those elected officials to lobby policymakers. These seven themes are not exhaustive, but when I have considered the history of American engagement with the rest of the world, they have always struck me as useful signposts. They act first and foremost as interpretive lenses that can be used on their own or, if the picture is particularly complex or unclear, by overlaying one or more on top of another. They are also interrelated. For instance, free security's autonomy to choose a foreign policy not based on preventing invasion and occupation helps explain why both values and domestic politics have wielded such a heavy influence over such a long period of time. Chapter 1. First Principles. The United States began its existence as an act of foreign policy. Indeed, it's no exaggeration to say that the nation owes its very existence to the successful pursuit of war and diplomacy. Over a period of 40 years, from the outbreak of revolution in 1775 to the end of war with Britain in 1815, the founding generation established and consolidated a new nation by responding to a series of international challenges. Along the way, they established a set of first principles of foreign relations, namely unilateralism, exceptionalism, and expansionism, that would shape Americans' engagement with the wider world for centuries to come. The New Republic. Until the mid-1770s, the residents of what would become the United States were subjects of the British Crown and considered a part of the British Empire. It took a series of imperial crises to stimulate demands for independence on the part of the American colonies. In 1763, after defeating France in the Seven Years' War, Britain became the dominant European power over the eastern half of North America. In order to maintain peace with American Indians, who still inhabited most of the continent, British officials established the Proclamation Line along the spine of the Appalachian Mountains and prohibited colonial settlement beyond it. A few years later, they began to tax the North American colonists for the costs of war with France. Both measures infuriated the colonists, who considered westward expansion as both a natural right and an economic necessity. British authorities cracked down on dissent, further agitating rebellious sentiment. After tensions escalated in the early 1770s, with British measures such as the so-called Intolerable Acts and the Quebec Act provoking increasingly furious protests, war broke out in Massachusetts in the spring of 1775 with the battles of Concord and Lexington. The decisive break with Britain came a year later, when the Continental Congress gathered in Philadelphia to present and sign the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration's main purpose was to unite more firmly what had been until then a loose collective of disparate and often disputatious individual colonies. In other words, to form a new independent union. The authors of the Declaration wanted their new nation to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station. But to do that, they needed to defeat the British, which required allies. Thus, another of the Declaration's objectives was to appeal to Britain's rivals in Europe, especially France, and demonstrate that there was now no turning back from revolution. Appealing to a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, the rebels sought to air their grievances with Britain and let facts be submitted to a candid world. The Declaration of Independence, then, was a call for assistance as much as it was a demonstration of resolve. In launching the American Revolution, the colonists needed to balance their ambitions for national independence with the need to forge military and diplomatic ties with Britain's rivals, France and Spain. On one hand, foreign alliances were vital. The British possessed the most powerful military in the world. The Royal Navy alone was powerful enough to make life difficult for the United States, and ever since the Seven Years' War, the British had had a large presence of troops in North America. There was little chance that the new United States would succeed without partners and support. Indeed, the Continental Congress already was smuggling in large quantities of arms and materiel from continental Europe. On the other hand, if the rebels promised too much to the French and the Spanish, the forging of alliances could undermine the very independence for which the colonists were fighting. John Adams, a Massachusetts lawyer and one of the leading figures of the American Revolution, thought he had found a way to align with partners while retaining American autonomy. In 1776, he drafted the Model Treaty, which provided a template for the new nation's foreign relations. Adams believed that the new nation could not survive as a vassal of one of the European powers, A product of Puritan New England, he was also deeply anti-Catholic and distrustful of monarchy. Shaped by the unavoidable specter of France's power, but designed nonetheless to be an enduring blueprint for the role of the United States in the world, the Model Treaty set out to prevent Americans from becoming entangled in the political affairs of foreign allies, especially their squabbles with other countries. Adams prioritized commerce on the assumption that the new nation required foreign trade for its survival, but he made sure to avoid any permanent political or military commitments, such as indefinite non-aggression or mutual assistance pacts in the event of war. This was a kind of declaration of independence in world affairs, the earliest expression of American unilateralism, and it was no coincidence that the Continental Congress had commissioned it as part of the deliberations that produced the Declaration. Yet, for now, the French were wary of an open partnership with the rebels and not quite ready for an open confrontation with London. The first 2 years of the Revolutionary War were difficult for both sides. Neither the British nor the Americans could sustain enough momentum to mount a winning campaign. After short-lived American victories, Boston, a stronghold of anti-British agitation, was trapped under siege for nearly a year, while British generals won a series of battles around New York City and pursued the main American army, under the command of George Washington, into New Jersey. Washington was able to stem the British advance at Trenton and Princeton in December 1776 and January 1777, respectively, but his troops had suffered tremendously. The first major American victory didn't come until the fall of 1777, when soldiers surrounded British General John Burgoyne and his troops near Saratoga, New York, and forced their surrender. The British, by most measurements the stronger side, were becoming increasingly frustrated at their inability to quell the insurgency. Yet, despite Saratoga, the war was far from over. From an American standpoint, the campaign for independence had scored some notable triumphs, but ultimate success was still uncertain. The Americans thus had little choice but to cement an alliance with France, which was eager to weaken Britain's power and prestige and earn a measure of revenge for the 7 years' war. An alliance with France may have been necessary, but for the rebel government, the trick was to maintain American independence, not only from Britain but also from the demands of its new sponsors in Paris. Burgoyne's surrender at Saratoga, following the Declaration of Independence, convinced the French that the American rebellion was credible. The Franco-American alliance, a secret up to that point, could now come out into the open. Contrary to Adams's designs, the diplomatic mission to Paris, headed by Benjamin Franklin, had to make some uncomfortable promises. The Model Treaty was supposed to be adaptable to different circumstances, but the underlying premise, that America must avoid becoming entangled in foreign commitments, was pragmatically sacrificed to the urgent need for an alliance with France. Franklin didn't have to give away too much, however. A vow not to sign a separate peace with Britain, and a promise to help France recover lost territories in the Caribbean, and the Franco-American alliance was sealed in February 1778. This was a decisive moment. Alone against Britain, the Americans were unlikely to prevail, at least in the near term. But in partnership with France, which could also apply pressure elsewhere in the world, the American insurgency had every chance of success. Encouraged by the French, Spain, and the Netherlands joined the campaign against Britain, while other European nations, among them Russia, Sweden, Denmark, Prussia, and Portugal, undermined the British blockade of North America by maintaining neutral shipping and trading rights. The Revolutionary War lasted 8 years, ending only with the surrender of British forces at Yorktown, Virginia in 1781 and the signing of a peace treaty in Paris in 1783. European intervention was important, with French forces proving especially critical right up to the Battle of Yorktown. With the signing of the Treaty of Paris, the United States was recognized, even by Great Britain, as a sovereign state in the international system. The aims of the Declaration of Independence had been met. The United States could now claim, in theory, as much legitimacy as any other state, including Britain itself. Out of many. The legitimacy of the United States, however, existed only on paper, and it was immediately apparent that the country lacked something else just as important: power. Partly this was due to the nature of the newly independent American states, which assumed that they would be acting more or less as autonomous bodies in a loose confederation, rather than as subject to and part of a centrally organized single national body. Potentially strong in the aggregate, they were actually quite weak as a collective. It wasn't as if the leaders of the revolution had forgotten about the needs of national governance. Even as fighting raged during the Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress had been busy erecting a framework for a new government called the Articles of Confederation. But by providing for a weak central government that lacked an executive or taxing authority, the Articles reflected the former colonies' desire to protect their autonomy. The problem of 13 sovereignties pulling against each other and all tugging at the federal head, Washington warned James Madison in 1786, threatened to undermine national cohesion from the very start. The new states couldn't negotiate treaties or enter into a foreign war on their own, but nor could Congress negotiate treaties with other countries that would affect the rights of individual American states. It was an unworkable system of government. More to the point, it was also a dangerous one, particularly for an upstart republic that was economically dependent on overseas trade. On land and at sea, the United States was beset by foreigners, encroaching on their sovereignty. By the peace terms signed in 1783, Britain had agreed to cede all territorial claims west to the Mississippi River, south to Spanish Florida, and north to the Great Lakes. This essentially doubled the size of the nation as originally constituted by the original 13 colonies, and meant that Congress had a huge swath of additional territory to defend. Isolated, sparsely populated territory at that. In the South, the Spanish, who had not signed the Treaty of Paris, disputed U.S. land claims. In the North, the British may have relinquished territory, but their troops remained on what was now legally U.S. soil. And throughout the United States, to the north, south, and in the west, American Indians fiercely contested attempts by the new national government to exert its authority. These problems of sovereignty were compounded by the ceaseless migration of white Anglophone settlers westward. It's probably inaccurate to refer to them collectively as Americans, even after 1783, because their loyalty to the United States was uncertain and often tenuous. As settlers poured over the Appalachians into what are now the states of Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, they came into conflict with American Indians, who in turn were encouraged and supplied by the British and the Spanish. All through the 1780s, warfare was constant along the trans-Appalachian borderlands. The situation was little better at sea. The 13 colonies had long prospered from economic relations with other nations, and maritime commerce was essential to American prosperity. Without it, the viability of the United States was doubtful. American merchants and shippers had always benefited from the protective blanket of Britain's Royal Navy, which was now, at best, an unsympathetic neutral. Without protection, American ships fell prey to pirates and privateers. Their most frequent predators were raiders from the Barbary states of North Africa, essentially what are now the countries of Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Libya, which harassed and captured U.S. ships in the Mediterranean and the Eastern Atlantic. Ransom payments freed the ships and their crews, but did nothing to discourage further raids. Even when ships sailing under the U.S. flag avoided attack, they found that British and Spanish colonial ports were closed to them. With no standing army at its disposal, no navy to speak of, and no authority to raise taxes, Congress was powerless to defend the United States from outside attackers. Without an effective central coordinating body to oversee the nation's foreign or military policies, Congress also had trouble promoting its national interests, such as free trade and neutral shipping that would help overcome the protective mercantilist barriers that barred Americans from lucrative trade routes in the Caribbean. Although the State Department had technically come into existence, it was a toothless body left to the mercy of the whims of the individual states. In fact, under the Articles of Confederation, the United States couldn't really have a foreign policy. Have we valuable territories and important posts in the possession of a foreign power which, by express stipulations, ought long since to have been surrendered? An exasperated Alexander Hamilton asked readers of the Federalist Papers. Thanks to British and Spanish predations in the Great Lakes and the Southwest, the answer was painfully obvious. Are we in a condition to resent or to repel the aggression? The answer again was just as clear. We have neither troops, nor treasury, nor government. Without a foreign policy, America's ability to operate as an independent nation in the world was compromised. But much more than trade was at stake. The very survival of the United States was in question. If it couldn't fend off or even deter British, Spanish, and American Indians along its extensive land borders, if it couldn't legally gain access to maritime European trade, and if it couldn't protect itself against Barbary pirates, then the United States would likely fall apart due to foreign land grabs, American Indian warfare, and secessionist movements. Hamilton's searching questions reflected broader concerns about the nation's standing in the world. To overcome American weakness abroad, which was also eroding national cohesion within the new country, in 1787, Congress authorized the drafting of a new national constitution. This would, the founders hoped, legitimize the upstart United States in the eyes of skeptical Europeans, even though sympathetic to the American Republic doubted it could survive for very long. As the historian Eliga Gould puts it, a new constitution that enabled a more stable and centralized government would make the new nation treaty-worthy, that is, a country with which other countries could do business. Without that legitimacy, Americans would be left vulnerable in the world. Foreign policy concerns weren't the only motivation behind the decision to replace the Articles of Confederation with a new constitution, but they were among the most important. When drafting was finished, the Constitution provided for a much stronger central government, including a chief executive, the president, who would serve as commander-in-chief, and a strong legislature, Congress, that could raise taxes and collect customs and duties, and thus fund a proper military. Guided by Madison's theories of federalism, in which the executive and legislative branches would have separate but overlapping powers, the President and Congress both had oversight of foreign affairs and national defense. Only Congress could declare war, but once the armed forces were deployed, the President was in charge. Only the President and his cabinet officials could negotiate treaties with foreign governments, but the Senate had the sole power of ratification and could thus veto any treaty the President signed. The President could appoint anyone to serve as Secretary of State or War, but they, too, had to be confirmed by the Senate, giving the legislature a large voice in foreign affairs. Over time, but especially in the 20th century, the balance of power between the branches of government tilted increasingly in favor of the executive. The founders felt the nation couldn't survive without stronger mechanisms for the United States to defend itself and advance its interests. Is the incredible power of the American presidency in the early 21st century the end result of pirate raids off the coast of Northwest Africa 250 years ago? That would be an exaggeration, but not by much. Navigating a world at war. Whatever future problems lay in store, the Constitution, ratified and put into effect in 1789, placed America's relations with the rest of the world on firmer ground. However, that's not to say events proceeded smoothly and without crisis. From the outset, The 1790s presented immensely difficult systemic challenges as the United States found itself caught between the two superpowers of the day, Britain and France, and the war they fought almost without interruption until the final defeat of Napoleon.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?